Anyways,
well, I've been writing poetry since I was pretty young, but I've never really recited as part of a group. I mean, I've recited in groups, and Karen's been my teacher for many years and is an extraordinary teacher in that she's able to bring things out in people that surprise people so much, including myself. So,
how did she become your teacher? Did you go to a workshop or something, or did you was it less formal?
You just started enrolling in workshops.
I think I just started going to workshops and got addicted.
So that was how you got in. How long ago was it that you got into poetry?
I've been writing for years, sure. How many years? 60?
Probably 60.
I love the way words sound. I always did, and I'd always make up my own songs and love nursery rhymes, the way they chant and run together. And then when I was in school, I would memorize different things because of the way they sounded. Mm-hmm. And then at some point I got really enamored of Vachel Lindsay, who is...
Bucks
in a wine barrel, barrel house, getting beat unstable, pegged in real limb pocket. And it's just like, if you hear him read, you know, he goes to a point, and I saw the tongue cutting through the black, cutting through the jungle with a golden truck. And it's just really, it's electrified. So I thought, well, gosh, if poets can do that, I can do that, you know, I can do that. And so I do.
And the thing about Nancy that I love is that it's not just the sounds of words, but the sounds of sounds that she integrates into her writing. I mean, one of my favorite pieces that came out of her in a total surprising setting was a poem that began with barking. Uh-huh. And it was a Zen Buddhist poem in many ways, I think. It, you know, it really kind of spoke to the impossible situation of being alive. It was marvelous. And she'll just integrate all these things in, sound-wise, but she also just has one of the more amazing voices I've ever heard for reading poetry and what she does with her voice. So she totally inhabits wherever it goes without limits.
That's true.
She might start speaking French, she might start barking, anything could happen. Yeah.
Will you do the barking poem on the 19th?
Absolutely. All that's right. Dharma Dog.
I'm excited to hear that one.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really excited not just to be at the event and get to read and have an audience, but I am so looking forward to hearing these other amazing women do their thing. The only time I've heard Nancy read is at the Women's Health Discussion Group when we had that writing erotic romantic
Valentine's Day erotic.
Yeah, it was writing
and romance.
Right. Yeah, you read some of the things you read that you wrote there, and I've heard Dixie read several times. I don't think I've heard you read yet, Karen, and I'm looking forward to it a lot. So I've been telling people it's more bang for your poetry buck,
even well, considering though it's free.
Yeah.
And Dixie's making cookies.
She's a killer cooker. She makes incredible cookies and incredible poems. And Dixie will just go to such depth of experience and kind of honest reckoning with the deepest stuff of life in her poetry.
Totally compelling.
I could listen to her for hours. So I'm really looking forward to hearing you. Because I've just heard you, you know, in the workshop.
Oh, right.
Can we just go around briefly, kind of like Nancy was doing, I guess, and just, I guess, Chantal, you next. Maybe just tell me a little bit about your, why you write poetry personally, maybe how you got into it or why you do it, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot, whether I write poetry to share it or if I just write it for myself. I guess I've been writing ever since elementary school, but not poetry, more stories, and less now, but at times of my life, I've been a mega letter writer. I guess I really just started writing poetry maybe... I wrote a couple in my early 20s, but not much. When I lived in Austin, probably around 98, I think, is when I started really seriously thinking I wanted to write more poetry. I wrote a poem about a cantaloupe, and I was just so thrilled with it, just so thrilled with my own work, that I just wanted to read it again and again and just wanted to feel that way about words. It was kind of addictive. And then it was an added bonus, I think, when I shared it with people and people were pleased with it. And that's how I feel. Like, I guess I mostly write for myself, and then if other people like what I do, that's an added bonus. My poetry's really taken off since I've lived in Lawrence, and I'm not sure if that's because I've had more time or...
Kansas influence.
Maybe the Kansas influence. But last summer when I decided to apply to do a work exchange at the Harveyville Project in Harveyville, Kansas, I guess I had never really felt like a real artist or a real poet. And I decided basically that I just wanted to get out of town for a month. And when I submitted my poetry and then they agreed to have me for a month-long residency, I guess that's when I really felt like, oh, I'm a real poet. I am a real poet.
Well, I write because I really just don't have a choice. I came into this world wired to create something. On a regular basis, and I think that was one of those hardwiring things that, you know, there was never any other option. When I was really young, I drew all the time. I just constantly drew these very somewhat abstract art pictures. I was very fond of snakes entangled with themselves for on and on and on. And art was my life. And I was also somewhat of a hyperactive kid, and my parents gave me a piano, and I could sit there for 2 hours and not move, just playing. Well, moving somewhat. And then, when I was 14, my parents had a very outlandish divorce where nobody would move out of the house for a year. It was a little like the movie The War of the Roses, where people just start destroying the house around one another. And in the middle of that, two things happened. One was that I was watching a friend who was in art class with me who spent 8 hours doing a pen and ink drawing. 8 hours on a pen and ink drawing, just doing like a 2-inch by 2-inch corner of it. And in my mind, this very faulty sentence got lodged. Oh, if this is art, I don't have the patience for it. And the other thing was, because of the insanity of the divorce, I just found I needed words. So I sat down and I started writing. And I completely stopped art, which I've since gone back to. But I just would write for 6-7 hours a day. A friend just found me who had lost me for 20 years, one of my oldest friends. And she said, I remember going to the beach with you. I grew up in New Jersey. And, you know, everybody would be out hanging around the water and doing this and that, and you would be sitting on a rock writing. Nobody could get you to move. When I see teenagers like that today, I think, oh, yes, I remember that. So writing was so core to, how can I say it? I had to create something, and I think the more I wrote, the more I imprinted on myself that I was a writer, and that writing became the main source of my own survival. So I started in poetry. I ended up getting a degree in labor history.
From where?
From the University of Missouri. I got involved with activism and political organizing, and I ended up doing that for 5 years full-time as an organizer. But I needed to write, and I kind of wasn't cut out for doing full-time organizing so well. My skin was too thin. I'd come home and just weep into the couch every night. And then I went back to school when I was living in Lawrence, Kansas, here for love, still here for love. And figured, well, the university's here, I'm here. And I did a master's, and then I did a very torturous PhD. And I didn't know why I was doing that, but I did know I was studying poetry the whole time. And as it turned out, getting those credentials, which were in some ways like walking through some of the rings of hell, I'm not sure I'd recommend that to many people, but in any case, getting that allowed me to work at Goddard, where I work with MA students one-on-one very intensively, and it allowed me to get through some doors to do workshops and to reach other populations. So I guess that's a very long-winded way of saying how I got there, but I write fiction and nonfiction and poetry. But I kind of live to write. You know, in my mind, I'm always plotting how I can escape everything and go write for long hunks of time.
Hey, I'm interested if anybody had a family history of writing, or if that was like encouraged.
Only divorce and mental illness.
My father could not read or write.
Really?
Really?
He went to school in Tennessee, and then the family decided, first or maybe, I don't think he got to second grade, bring him home, and he worked at home. And so when he was...
Why'd he stop to work? Just to work, to work at home with the family?
In the fields. I mean, they were subsistence farmers. They did not, they were hill people, and nobody had an education. I was the first one to get a high school diploma, let alone go to college. So,
was he a storyteller, though?
He was a storyteller. Mm. He did tell stories. And the family told a lot of, they had a big oral tradition. And so that was there. And my mother went through ninth grade twice, as she put it. And she was an artist.
Like what, like painting or drawing, that kind of artist? Or
she's actually a collected folk artist at the Lucas Folk Art Museum. And she made cameos out of chewing gum and window caulk and road tar and
apples that went bad,
grapefruit skins,
made into faces.
Wow. Things like that.
Very good with an orange.
Yeah, her orange piranhas are noted all over the country.
Yeah, huh. Yeah, your mother was amazing.
Pretty incredible, right?
Yeah, I was just wondering, because I think a lot of times, people I know who have kids think that their kids are going to be like them. And I know that, nobody in my family writes. We definitely come from a storytelling tradition. But I'm just kind of, you were saying, you feel like you were hardwired to create art. I'm just so... It's so interesting to me,
where we come into the world.
Yeah, where that comes from,
nobody
nature versus nurture.
I know, it's very interesting because my family, they're not writers or storytellers. They're more into singing along with Broadway musicals while vacuuming. I come from a family of singers. People love to sing. I grew up with Barbara Streisand and Mario Lanza blasting through the house, which probably has affected my brain in ways that I still can't quite fathom. But it's kind of a joke and a delight among my siblings, that I'm a writer. And they read what I write. I mean, one of my favorite stories was hearing from my brother, who works in New York City as the, if I can even remember this, he supervises web design for advertising for Fortune 500 companies at some big company. He's an office on Madison Avenue, you know. And he's just a total sweetheart. You know, he's been really quiet. And I sent him my book, Animals in the House, and he told me, you know, he's riding the subway and the ferry reading my poetry. And liking it and understanding it. And that to me meant so much that somebody completely outside of that world could enter into it.
Yeah.
And that's to me what's, you know, one of the driving things in my life is to kind of bring up that creative spark or help people see that in themselves no matter where they are.
Karen, the midwife of the poetry.
I kind of see myself more like, we burn the prairie each year, and you know, you drag fire to burn the prairie. We live in the country, and we have prairie to burn. You get a pitchfork, and you kind of wrap grasses around it like spaghetti, and you light it on fire, and you drag it. I kind of see that as my role.
That's a good...
And just seeing, you know, what ignites, because one of the things I rail against is the whole keeper of the art notion in this country, that the literary elite is the keeper of what's published and what's chosen, and the artist elite is the keeper of that art, and the music elite. And, you know, the older I get, the more I just feel like, fuck all that, you know? We can, especially with how technology's changed, we can create readings and publications and gallery shows and music and all these things right here with our own hands, and nobody can stop us. And to me, it's much more exciting to see a glorious reading or gallery show or concert, even if parts of it are a complete disaster, where somebody's putting themselves out there and taking those artistic risks, and none of it's canned, then, you know, to see something that's kind of put out the same way in the same venue type in cities across the country.
Yeah.
My first memory of anything at all was reaching up to touch the radio, and my father saying, "Don't you touch that. That's the Grand Ole Opry."
That's such a great story.
And I think what fascinated me was the singing and then the rhyme. And it always, the rhythm and the rhyme and the connection between words have always been so much fun for me.
It resonates with our heartbeat, with just the way the sounds even move in our bodies.
Yeah, that's right.
Sometimes I just feel so much pleasure from words that are put together in a way that I don't even know, in a way that touches me. I can't even explain it. Like, I can't explain it to people who don't love words that much already. Just the way things sound or a fresh expression. I think we live so clogged up by cliches that when something is fresh, that means so much to me. And a lot of times, if I'm reading poetry, even if the whole poem doesn't resonate with me, or I'm not too thrilled about the whole poem, if even just two or three words fit together in a really fresh way that strikes me, it's worth the whole thing.
Absolutely.
I would say, don't be afraid to listen to your windshield wipers and hear what words come out of them and see, you know, you might find yourself driving along the road just going wappa wappa wah wah, wappa wappa wah wah, wappa wah, wappa wah, wappa wappa, and you might find something in that, a comfort, and then from that you might develop some other words. Don't be afraid, don't remember what your English teachers taught you, and don't ever think you're wrong. Think you're right every time. Give yourself the permission to put any word together that sounds fun or delightful or touches you in some way, like Chantel was saying. You know, and anybody can do that, anytime. So just don't fear those words and those rhymes, and don't be afraid of being silly, and come and hear our poetry, and then you certainly won't be afraid after that.
Yeah, I think not being afraid to be silly has really helped me a lot.
Yeah. And not being afraid of how it looks to other people can just help you break through. I was just going to add to this that I think that we're alive really just for two things, you know. One is to break our hearts open, and that will happen on its own. You know, you don't have to really do much to make that happen. As you get older, people you love will die. Sometimes when you're younger, things will fall apart. You know, there's the whole impermanence thing that's constantly in motion. And writing can be just such a great comfort and way to find deeper meaning in the losses that we have everywhere. You know, like as Elizabeth Bishop says, the art of losing isn't hard to do, which is a line I just love. And, you know, she goes on and on to show how, and that poem is actually called One Art, you know, how art itself can help you not just survive, but kind of find the richness and depth and texture. And the other thing I think we're alive for is to continually expand our vision. And good poetry to me is almost this horizontal thing where it just, I feel it kind of stretching out how I see the world. You know, and I'll see things out of the corner of my eyes that I won't have seen before because of the poem. You know, like there's a line that I love in Theodore Rethke's poem, The Waking, which is also a villanelle, and this French
That's
form.
That's my favorite poem.
I love that poem.
We learn by going where we have to go.
I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. And there's this line, what falls away is always and is near. And as I've gotten older, I've just understood that line in ways I never could before, and I probably still have decades of understanding, so much so that I co-wrote a song about that line with Kelly Hunt, that, you know, just as a way to kind of inhabit what it means that what falls away is always and is near. And I feel like it just has stretched out, you know, a lot of lines in that poem, in fact. Stretched out just how I can perceive the world. It's like maybe through culture we're taught to see this way, and poetry is a way of stretching that out.
If you're young, poetry writing will make you wise, and if you're old, it will make you young.
That's a great.
Did you make that up?
Yeah.
Excellent. Just now?
Yeah.
That's wow. Great.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
It's very true.
Yeah. A lot of times what I try to do in my poems is write about really specific things, like how eating this cantaloupe made me feel, or how the thunderstorm last night made me feel, or how it feels to lie in my bed and hear the first birds of spring come back. And I like taking those really specific things that we experience every day that I think are really easy to overlook when we're going to work and, you know, going to the grocery store and living our day-to-day lives. I think it's really easy sometimes to forget the pleasure in that ice cold watermelon, or the pleasure in hearing the birds sing. So that's sort of one of my main ways of writing poetry, although I've really tried to branch out in the last year and try to write villanelles and try to write sestinas and just sort of teach myself a lot of the forms so that I'm a better, well-rounded poet, I think. But I think it's so important to really feel those little things about nature and about each other that are just so easy to overlook.
The sensory details. Mm.
It's funny, I took a poetry class at KU once, and what you were saying about fresh, you know, words and stuff. There was this one girl in this class who was Korean and didn't even, you know, didn't speak English very well. But her poems, they'd be pretty rough sometimes, you know, but sometimes she would just have the weirdest phrasings that were just kind of her trying to say it, you know, regular, but it just came out odd. But it was so awesome, you know, it was so cool sometimes the way she would phrase things from the fact that she didn't speak English very well.
I kind of love seeing American phrases translated into Japanese for that reason.
Yeah.
I have a coworker who's Costa Rican, and she's very fluent in English, but they were talking yesterday. One time, she was trying to say, keep your eyes peeled, but it came out, peel your eyes.
I've been typing lately. One of the things I'm doing is writing a book about a Holocaust survivor, and I was transcribing the interviews with him, and he grew up in Poland, and just the way he would phrase sentences. Mm-hmm. Where you kind of start with the noun, like, you know, the Nazis, you know, whoever would have thought, you know. Uh-huh. Or just the way he would use verbs, which sometimes wasn't the grammatical English way to do it. Which probably should have put that in the paper in case he sees
it. No, this is kind of a
okay. Anyway, but just the way